Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our 3 o'clock docket this afternoon, and if council is ready, our clerk will call the first case.
The court will now call Charles Stovall versus the state of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Reagan Nguyen will argue for the appellant. Mr. Charles Dawson will argue for the state.
May it please the court. I'm here today on behalf of Charles Stovall. Mr. Stovall was convicted by Denton County jury of murdering his wife and got 25 years in prison. I don't think you're going to find a case, reported or non-reported, on quite this factual pattern. There is no physical evidence of any kind in this case. No body, no blood, no nothing. Now, there are lots of cases out there where it's a murder conviction and there's sufficiency questions and there's evidence of intent and motive and whether or not intent and motive get you there or not. But there are no cases out there where you've got intent and motive and no body, no physical evidence. I would like to talk to you about three issues today. We have six in our brief. I want to talk to you about sufficiency in some detail. I would like to briefly address point of error two, which concerns the exclusion of a videotape that the defense offered. And I want to talk to you briefly about point of error six, which has to do with quashing a subpoena for a juror in a motion for new trial as opposed to bringing the juror to court, letting them be asked questions, and then having a timely objection entered and an opportunity to make a bill of exception. In the last 5 years, sufficiency review in Texas has undergone a lot of change. You know, if you look back to 2007, we get the Hooper decision. And Hooper is really important because before 2007, we had this note, and you got to put Hooper in the context of, at the time of Hooper, we still had Cluis. So you still had this factual sufficiency standard bouncing around out there. But Hooper comes in, and Hooper is, it's a parties case. It's about whether or not the getaway driver was responsible for the passenger shooting at a cop as they were driving away from a robbery. In Hooper, Judge Myers goes out and he says, okay, we've got all this talking about inferences and we think inferences are okay, and then we have cases that say you can't have speculation. Well, now we're going to try and tell you what all that means. And they tell you that an inference is a conclusion reached by considering other facts and deducing a logical consequence from them. And then he tells you that speculation is mere theorizing or guessing about the possible meaning of facts and evidence presented. Now, that's about as clear as mud to me, but at least it is some guidance as to what speculation is. And the other thing they told us in Hooper that I think is really important in this case, any speculation, even if it's reasonable, is insufficient to support a verdict beyond a reasonable doubt. The second thing that happens that I think is really important is you need to go back and read Brooks versus State, which doesn't directly apply in this case. Brooks is the case where they did away with Cluis, and they did away with factual sufficiency. But if you read Brooks very carefully, they say, one of the things they go in there and they say, you know, we had this idea that we had to have factual sufficiency because you could really have an unjust result with the standard, this sort of onerous standard for legal sufficiency. But the truth of the matter is the standard for legal sufficiency is so rigorous and so hard that it basically consumes the factual sufficiency standard. And where you see this come out, Judge Cochran talks about it in her dissenting opinion in Gear, which is cited in our brief. And what she talks about is this rigorous standard and how don't you know doesn't get you there. So with all of this in mind and how the law is developing in sufficiency, I think this case really comes down to two questions. I'll be honest with you, I'm not going to talk to you too much about the facts. I think the briefs lay out what the evidence is and isn't in this case pretty clearly. And I went back and read the briefs this morning, and I really don't see that we have a big dispute between any of us about what the testimony was and what it wasn't. I've tried to lay out what I thought the state's best evidence was. They've laid it out. It looked like it was about the same to me. The real question is, I will dispute this, we don't concede identity. I think the real question is, it's kind of identity mixed with causation. Is there enough evidence to say that a rational juror could say Charles Stobaugh caused Kathy Stobaugh's death? And while you look at Merritt versus State, that's a case that came out in April this year out of the Court of Criminal Appeals. Merritt's an arson insurance fraud case. Guy burns up a car in a field and then files an insurance claim on it. And the question was, the Court of Appeals actually reversed it and said, well, you can't prove he was the one that burned up the car. Court of Criminal Appeals said, yes, you can. He had motive and opportunity, and those are both indicative that it would be him, identity, that would go to prove identity. But you look at what else they had in Merritt. He had the only two keys to the car, the steering column on the car. Nobody had messed with it, so they had an expert came in and said the only way that car got there was if somebody put a key in the ignition, turned it, and drove it there. He had the only two keys. He had the contents of the vehicle. He had claimed his car was stolen, but when they searched his house, they found a bag that had all the stuff that looked like it came out of the glove box of the car. So there was something there past motive and opportunity, which seemed to tie him to the crime. The Court of Criminal Appeals said it was enough. I think a case that we didn't cite in our brief but cited in theirs is going to be really important, and unfortunately for you, you're not going to know the answer. It's called Temple v. State, 342 Southwest 3rd, 572nd. It's a case out of the Houston Court of Appeals. It is Pett granted, and it is Pett granted on this particular issue. Temple is a husband who is accused of killing his wife. A lot of the same kinds of testimony we had in this case, domineering husband, controlling, and his basic story was, I took our son out to go run some errands. I came home, found my wife. She's dead. She's in the closet. Somebody put a shotgun to the back of her head and killed her. The Court of Appeals said, well, you know, his alibi wasn't perfect. There was, you know, a 20-minute window in there where he could have been there to do it. You know, they had all this evidence of motive. He had been having an affair with another woman, and immediately after his wife died, he resumed the affair with this other woman. And they said that was enough. Well, the Court of Criminal Appeals has granted PDR, appellant's PDR, to review that. And I think when you look at Judge Cochran's dissenting opinion in Gear, I think it's going to be pretty clear where that decision is going to come down. I think the other case that's close is one we've cited in our opinion. That's Reedy versus State out of the Austin Court of Appeals. Reedy is the homeless camp murder. This guy had set up a home, like a little campground out in some area in Austin, and a body ends up found there, and looked like somebody bludgeoned the dead person in the back of the head. They had Reedy having a weapon. They had testimony about Reedy threatening somebody else with a hatchet. They had evidence of flight. Reedy, as soon as this guy's dead, takes off and hitchhikes back to Alabama. They had all that. The Austin Court of Appeals says the evidence is legally insufficient. And what's interesting about Reedy is Reedy was a perfect opportunity for the Court of Criminal Appeals to change that around, because in Reedy there was some inference stacking language. Well, after Reedy gets reversed by the Austin Court of Appeals, the Court of Criminal Appeals comes down in 2007 in Hooper and says, we don't talk about inference stacking anymore. That's not appropriate. They had the PDR, the state's PDR in Reedy, pending when they decided Hooper, and they end up refusing the state's PDR. So I think while Reedy, if you look it up in Westlaw, it says it's been abrogated because it has this inference stacking language. At the end of the day, Court of Criminal Appeals let that decision stand, and that was a legal sufficiency reversal and acquittal. So that talks about, do they have enough to prove that Charles Stobaugh caused the death? I think the real issue, and this is the one that I think is the most troubling, frankly, is even if they somehow get to, there is evidence from which a rational juror could have concluded beyond a reasonable doubt that Charles Stobaugh caused Kathy Stobaugh's death. From what evidence is it that he's intentionally or knowingly caused her death, or that he intended to cause serious bodily injury and did some act clearly dangerous to human life? If you look at Temple, that's the case I told you that's PDR pending. Temple, they say it in the right in the face of the opinion. Somebody shot this woman in the back of the head with a shotgun. It is obvious someone intentionally or knowingly caused her death. So in that case, the only question was identity. Well, we don't have that, because we don't know how Kathy Stobaugh died. And I would say that while we concede that a rational juror could conclude Kathy Stobaugh is dead. It was certainly a contested issue at trial, and there is no trace of her. They searched that property up and down, backwards and forwards, couldn't find anything. If you look at the case, there's just nothing to get you to intent. And this is precisely what Judge Cochran talked about in Gear. Gear is a case where a guy breaks into a house and gets charged with burglary with intent to commit theft. It had to be, they had to get intent to commit theft, otherwise it's a trespass. He didn't take anything. He didn't try to take anything. He didn't take any action to try to take anything. But the, you know, in his argument was, I was in the house, but you got no evidence of intent. Well, the Court of Criminal Appeals ultimately said it was there. But look at Judge Cochran's dissent, because she said, what this comes down to is, don't you know he did it? Why else would he break in? And that's not enough. And I will submit to you that that's where they are going to be headed in Temple, is to address Judge Cochran's concerns in Gear. At the end of the day, you know, the state, they put this Texas Ranger on the witness stand. And I will tell you that reading this appellate record, if you haven't done it yet, you're going to have some fun, because what happens is there's all these exhibits and evidence and people just start talking about them and nobody identifies what they're talking about. It appears from reading the record that they did some sort of recreation with the ranger and the prosecutor, I guess down in the well in the courtroom, and they're reenacting how he thinks this could have happened. And he has this whole story, this ranger, it's set out in our brief about, well, I think he got her in the garage, and then he got behind her with a ligature, and he choked her to death, and then he took the body and he hid it. Well, they've got zero evidence, physical evidence, to support that. They searched that house up and down. They couldn't find any evidence of a struggle. They found all kinds of things that could have been ligatures. None of them have any biological material on them. That is speculation at best. And that's as close as they could get. At the end of the day, while you may be able to say, well, don't you know he's the one who killed his wife? That's not enough. And that's not how we convict people in this country. And that's not what beyond a reasonable doubt means. With that in mind, I'd like to move on to point of error two. That's the exclusion of the tape. I'm not going to talk too much about whether or not it was authenticated. I think if you read Rule of Evidence 901 and you read the Tienda opinion from 2012 in the Court of Criminal Appeals, I don't think you can make a meaningful argument that it was not authenticated. We have all sorts of different evidence that says we know who the people on the tape are. If nothing else, it's authenticated because it looks like Defense Exhibit 15 to some extent, which appears to have been made under approximately the same circumstances. So the judge, who I think at one point talked about, well, we don't know if Little Green Men altered this tape. I mean, I watched the Super Bowl commercials this weekend, and I saw all kinds of things that could have been altered, so this couldn't be authenticated. It's simply not the standard. In authentication, the trial judge is the gatekeeper. He decides if there's enough to make it basically, if you read the Tienda opinion, it's to make a fact question, and then the jury decides how much they think it's worth. The real issue in point of error two is harm. In this case, as close as it is, and the state argues, well, Kathy Stobaugh was scared of him, and that's part of their sufficiency argument. That's why it was intentional, because he was some horrible guy that she was scared of. That's why you know he intentionally did it. This tape controverts that. They tell you in their brief, our central witness is Cherie Stobaugh, the daughter. They subjected her to a brutal cross-examination. They attacked her every way possible. Well, this videotape, it confirms what Cherie told that jury about the relationship between her mom and her dad. It was clearly admissible, and it was very harmful to exclude it, especially in the context of this close a case. The last thing I want to talk about briefly is the motion for new trial. I don't want to talk to you about whether or not the motion for new trial should have been granted. We'll stand on the briefs for that. But here's procedurally what they did. The defense attorneys go out, they interview the jury foreman, the jury talks about things that they think are jury misconduct. Lawyer swears out an affidavit, which is what you have to do to get the hearing on the motion for new trial, and says, I want to have a hearing, here's why we think we get it. They send a subpoena to the jury foreman. instead of bringing the jury foreman to court, doing question and answer, and subjecting them to the rules of evidence, where the state would have been free to stand up and say, we object under Rule 606B that he can't answer that particular question, they quashed the subpoena. So what we're left with is what the defense attorney put in the affidavit about what the juror told him. And, you know, one of our standalone issues is that this ought to get, if nothing else, kicked back for a real hearing on that motion for new trial. And the remedy for a evidence rules violation is you object and the evidence is excluded. And then the other side gets to make a bill of exception. It is not to quash the subpoena so that the witness never testifies. Imagine the logical extension of that rule. Well, I think that, you know, they're going to ask some irrelevant questions of this witness, so we just won't even call them. That ain't how it works. In this case, based on our record, at a minimum, we need to be sent back for a new hearing where we get the opportunity to present the evidence and have the objections, and then you can resolve it. Thank you.
Please the court. I'm Charlie Orbison from Denton County. I think you've already met Laura Tomlin. She was at a recent argument, but she is with me today. I find myself agreeing with some of what opposing counsel said and disagreeing with probably more than I agreed with. But starting out with the sufficiency issue, it is an unusual case. Kathy Stovall's body has not been found. We're approaching the 8th anniversary of her death. Her body has not been found. There's been no sign at all, zero, that she's ever breathed after the evening of December 29th, 2004. The last person that saw her alive was the appellant. I don't believe opposing counsel disputes that. Certainly the evidence supports it. Her car was found at his house. We know that she was at his house shortly before she disappeared off the face of the earth. No one in 8 years has indicated they've seen Kathy since she went out to appellant's house on that evening. It's an unusual case in that it has no body, but this state decided years ago that we weren't going to let murderers escape their responsibility simply because they did a good job of getting rid of the body. That's been the law in Texas for some time now. Not always, as the state pointed out in its brief, it is the law now that just because you do a good job of getting rid of the body doesn't mean that you're not going to be convicted for murder. True, there's no forensic evidence. I don't really know what we would expect unless it was a bloody type of death, which it obviously was not. Murder happened in Kathy Stovall's house, where she had lived a number of years. She was currently residing in a rented apartment in Singer, but she had lived in that house for a great many years. Her DNA was all over that house. Appellant's DNA, all over that house. What kind of forensic evidence are you going to get in that kind of scene? Unless it was a bloody death, which it was not. Although it's an unusual case, and obviously the state acknowledged that fact because of the mountain of evidence they put on, 13-day trial, jury was exposed to a great amount of evidence from which it could make rational inferences therefrom. Not talking about guesswork, as opposing counsel suggested the jury may have done here, talking about rational inferences derived from facts that were admitted into evidence. Now, opposing counsel talked a lot about the Hooper case. It's interesting in a couple of reasons.
I want to go back for 1 minute. What are the rational inferences and the evidence supporting them?
State believes, Your Honor, that there was powerful evidence of motive and opportunity. Case law clearly tells us that we can make inferences of guilt from strong evidence of motive and opportunity. Here, appellant was the only one who had the opportunity to kill Kathy. We know that because she wasn't seen anywhere or by anyone since she went out to his house that evening. We know there was a powerful motive for him to do so, and the state carefully brought that evidence before the jury. It was no secret that they were headed for divorce, but the testimony of Kathy's attorney demonstrated that they had met on Monday of that week, that the attorney had told Kathy that since appellate had essentially ignored the divorce petition, that she was now in a position to obtain a default judgment and to decide a fair distribution of the property. It could be the way she wanted it to be. We know, because he admitted, that appellate knew what that division of property was going to be. And we know, inferentially, from all the evidence about appellate's character, that that land was very important to him, the assets were very important to him, and they're probably graded for him to lose. I'm sorry.
But even given inferences of motive and opportunity, doesn't there have to be some evidence that would support an inference that the defendant did some type of intentional act?
I think we can infer intent from motive and opportunity and from all the other evidence in the case.
But that's what I'm asking. What is all the other evidence?
Because as the state's brief points out, there was
just motive and opportunity. There are a lot of people who have motive and opportunity and have committed no offense.
I would grant that, Your Honor, but there's very few who have motive and sole opportunity. In fact, the Hooper case that opposing counsel cited, the Court of Criminal Appeals was discussing, how do we know if it's a reasonable inference? And they gave an example. They said, walk into a room, there's a woman standing there with a smoking gun, and there's a body on the floor. They say, in that situation, you can infer she fired the gun because it's in her hand and it's smoking. But can you infer she shot the person laying on the floor? Well, not necessarily. You need more information. How about if there were five other people in the room? No, that would not be a reasonable inference that she shot the person laying on the floor. How about if there was nobody else in the room? Now we have a reasonable inference. She fired the gun. She fired the gun at the man on the floor. She shot him.
But
there was no other person.
Here we have nobody on the floor, and we have no gun.
Absolutely. And we have no manner and means tool at all. I mean, those are the facts of the case. But we have no one else who could have done it. Now, at trial, the defense tried to put it on Rocky Underwood, but I think the evidence fairly and convincingly showed that...
But it's not the defendant's burden to prove that someone else did it, correct?
Absolutely. I'm not suggesting that it is, Your Honor. I'm suggesting, what does the evidence show about who else could have done it? I'm not saying he had to prove his innocence. I'm saying, what does the evidence show about who could have killed Kathy? We now all accept, and I think even opposing counsel accepts, she's dead. I think we all accept she's dead by foul play. If it was an accident, we would have found her body, right? Probably would have been there in the farm where her car was. So we know that she's dead by murder, by homicide. Who could have done it? Who would have done it? Could it be a stranger? Stranger didn't know she was out there. Stranger wouldn't have brought the car back. It's silly to think it was a stranger. It had to be somebody who knew her, who knew where she was, and knew where her car was. That the evidence, it is the combined probative force of all this evidence that led the jury to the conclusion that appellate was guilty of murder. The other evidence, to get back to Justice Walker's question, the evidence, why do we think it was him? We know she's dead. We know she was killed. Why do we think it was him? Well, as I already pointed out, he had a very strong motive. But then let's look at all the many, and I summarize not all of them, but a good many of them in the brief, all the untruthful things he started saying, the inconsistent stories he started telling, the implausible statements that he made. That's an indication. That's an indication.
Which specific ones are you mentioning?
Because when I
was reading the brief, it seemed to me like those could raise an inference either way. You could say he didn't tell the same exact story word for word every time, which could also raise an inference that he's being truthful, spontaneous, telling it. He remembers it slightly different. He didn't go into the house because there was a restraining order due to the divorce.
There wasn't, but go ahead. He said that.
So I want to hear from you exactly which evidence you think raises these inferences.
First of all, in the statement of facts, this goes through the evidence in a fairly comprehensive way. But let's look at pages 30 to 31 of the state's brief. First, he lied about leaving phone messages. He told the police, I've been trying to call Kathy ever since she left, and I saw her car go down the driveway. Been trying to call her. Did you leave her messages? Yeah, I left her messages. He didn't, because he didn't know that police could access the phone log and could actually hear the messages that were left on her cell phone. He didn't know that, so he lied about that. Why would he lie about that? Well, he wanted to show that he was, he's not a murderer, that he cared about his wife. That's why he lied about that. He gave mutually exclusive first thoughts. Now, you might be able to have multiple inferences from that. I'm going to grant you that. I won't spend a lot of time with it. But what were your first thoughts? Well, my first thoughts were four different things. And there is a way of looking at that evidence that could support multiple inferences. Inconsistent statements about searching for Kathy before 9 a.m. on December 30th. The evidence showed, you have to piece it together. You got to look at what Cherie had told authorities and what she had told investigators from the district attorney's office, what she testified to, how she was cross-examined. But it was clear that the only time that appellant told Cherie that he had looked for Kathy was before Cherie came out the next morning at 9 o'clock. And then look at it as inconsistent statements about when he woke up. One of them has him waking up at 8:30. And yet he's searching all the barns in the house before 9 o'clock. It's implausible. It doesn't make sense. He told a number of people, authorities, that he had never seen any of the papers that Kathy had drawn up for the divorce. The evidence showed Kathy was trying to avoid an acrimonious divorce. And so she drew up various options for a disposition of the property. And she wanted agreement from her husband, still, as to what would be the best way to divide up the property. And he wouldn't cooperate, and he wouldn't, of course, agree to anything. He told authorities that he'd never seen any of those papers. He told a private investigator, yeah, he had seen them. And he had seen the papers that she drew up. Why was he telling one party one thing and another party another thing? Is it he couldn't remember what he had said to one other? That's possibly the case, but they are inconsistent statements. He lied about having a private investigator. In fact, he even said that he took $5,000 out of Kathy's money and paid for the private investigator because he was a concerned husband and wanted to find out what happened to his wife. Well, the state proved that to be a lie. No money came out of Kathy's account since her murder. That's one piece of evidence that showed that her life ended that night. So there was no evidence. It was an absolute lie that he took $5,000 out of Kathy's account in order to pay a private investigator. Also, the defense did not make any claim that he had a private investigator involved in this case at trial. His statement was inconsistent with his son's statement. His son said that appellant took him to Kathy's house so that appellant and Kathy could talk about the divorce. He said, well, I took Tommy to Kathy's house because Tommy wanted to go play video games. So there's inconsistency there. He gave inconsistent versions of Kathy's "you'll never see me again" speech before she left. where she allegedly said, "Well, you'll never see me again. Don't bother looking for me because you'll never find me." He gave inconsistent statements of whether what happened on December 29th when he admitted he talked to Kathy. He told certain people that, oh, it's just a calm and discussion. It told others that she got very mad. And then she gave her "you'll never see me again" speech. So that's just a few. You can't, I mean, the prosecutors go through the evidence, the various inconsistencies in some detail in the trial, as the court will read when it reads the record in this case. And it's very difficult to go through all of that in oral argument, but the state attempts to do that in the brief, and the state would ask the court, of course, to refer to the brief. He also did a number of questionable things in the aftermath. Those, I see I'm running out of time. I could go through the list, but you'll find them on pages 31 to 32 of the state's brief. And that includes going, sending his friend over and taking Kathy's computers, and then later saying, "Well, we're going to have them analyzed." And then at trial, we had an expert that said nobody had analyzed one computer he could tell. I see I'm out of time, so I haven't had time to get to the other issues that appellate brought up, but the state would pray that this court look at the state's brief and then affirm this conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Orbison.
Let me start with this. I'm trying to be intellectually honest here. I am not going to argue the evidence is insufficient to prove that she is dead. That does not mean I accept that she is dead, and it was a hotly contested issue at trial. I do think that there is a good argument to be that the evidence is insufficient, that not foul play wasn't the cause of her death. I mean, is it really more implausible that something weird happened and she had some kind of accident and they didn't find her body? Is that any more implausible than he somehow physically murdered her, either at his house, and there's no evidence of it there, no physical evidence of any kind, or that he, I guess, put her in a car, took her somewhere and killed her, and they got no evidence in the car of it? In this day and age, is it that really more implausible than some weird accident that nobody knows? And you kind of hit the nail on the head, Justice McCoy. I'll hit one more title before I'm done if I'm lucky. How do we prove what happened? We don't, and we don't have to. It is not our burden. Now, certainly, I could go through and talk about I didn't talk to you about the defense theories, about other people it could have been, because that's not the prism you view the evidence through. I mean, the jury heard that evidence. I guess they decided they didn't believe it. But under the standard, could a rational juror have found beyond a reasonable doubt, without speculating, that he's guilty? And simply put, no. The only way to get there is to speculate. You have to speculate that she died some kind of traumatic death. And then you have to speculate about how it happened and how he managed to do it without leaving any evidence. There's no evidence to support that.
Body or a crime scene with some sort of forensic evidence then?
Not necessarily. You would think there'd be evidence of something. And frankly, in all the cases that we see, there is some kind of forensic evidence. I mean, I think Justice McCoy hit the nail on the head again. We got no body. We got no smoking gun. I mean, look at Reedy. They've got a body with a blunt force trauma to the skull. Look at Temple. You've got a body with a shotgun blast to the back of the head. I mean, clearly, those are intentional or knowing, or evidence from which a jury could rationally conclude it was intentionally or knowing. Where do you get it here? There is nothing. Now, it's terrible Kathy Stobaugh's dead, gone, dead, whatever it is that's happened to her. And just like Judge Cochran says, you can go, well, don't you know he did it? He's the one that had the motive. And that may work on 2020, where this show got aired on national TV. That doesn't work in a courtroom. And if beyond a reasonable doubt means anything, it means you don't guess somebody guilty of murder. And that's what happened in this case. And y'all need to fix it. Thank you.
Thank you both. Your case is submitted. You are excused to go about your business, and we will proceed to hear the second case on our 3 o'clock docket.